morning. This is AM. I'm Michael Brissenden. As world leaders gather in New York for the General Assembly, the ground is shifting on the major global crisis of the moment, the Syrian civil war. Western governments, including Australia, are now openly canvassing the idea that finding a solution in Syria may mean leaving President Bashar al-Assad in power, at least in the short term. One reason for the shift is that Russia's President Vladimir Putin has moved troops and weapons into Syria to back his ally in Damascus. Now, Mr. Putin is calling on the West to join him in a joint campaign against Islamic State that could also include the Assad regime. North America correspondent Ben Knight reports.
Vladimir Putin's support for his ally Bashar al-Assad is no secret. But even so, it would seem to be folly for Russian forces who are already busy in eastern Ukraine to open a new battlefront in Syria. But Russian tanks, troops and fighter jets are on the ground in Syria and have reportedly made their first bombing raids against Islamic State targets. With that kind of support, Bashar al-Assad is not going anywhere. And that's something the United States and its allies have realised. Australia's Foreign Minister Julie Bishop says all options in Syria are on the table. But that doesn't mean Australia's position on Bashar al-Assad has softened.
That is realpolitik. That is being realistic. In 2011, there was a Geneva process that set out what the coalition partners believed was achievable at that time. It hasn't achieved it. So therefore, we should reconsider the position.
Later tonight, Vladimir Putin will deliver his address to the UN General Assembly, and he's expected to throw a new curveball at the US and its allies, inviting them to join Russia in a new coalition to fight against Islamic State in Syria. On Sunday, Vladimir Putin spoke to the US 60 Minutes program.
We're trying to establish some kind of coordinated framework. We would welcome a common platform for collective action against the terrorists.
But the trade-off is that Bashar al-Assad would remain in power. Because when Vladimir Putin talks about terrorists, he's not just talking about Islamic State. He's also talking about the Syrian rebels who are fighting against Bashar al-Assad. And Vladimir Putin says when America trains and arms those rebels, even if it's just to fight against Islamic State, it's breaking the law.
There is only one legitimate conventional army there, and that is the army of the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad. And he is confronted with what some of our international partners interpret as an opposition. But in reality, Assad's army is fighting against terrorist organizations.
Barack Obama has backed down before on Syria, on his threats to bomb the Assad regime for its use of chemical weapons. Back then, it was Vladimir Putin who helped to broker a solution. It may be that the Russian president holds the key to a broader solution to the Syrian crisis, but it could be a bitter pill for the US and its allies to swallow. This is Ben Knight in Washington, reporting for AM.
The government is setting the scene for another battle with the peak doctor's body, announcing it's starting consultation on a review of 5,700 services subsidised under the Medicare benefit schedule. The government argues the review is needed to reflect modern clinical practice, saying some procedures are unnecessary, outdated and potentially unsafe. But Labor and the Australian Medical Association say it's a direct attack on the profession's integrity and will lead to a cut in health services. I'm joined on the line by Shadow Health Minister Catherine King. Catherine King, good morning.
Good morning.
Do you accept that it is about time we had a review of the schedule? About 70% of the subsidised procedures or tests haven't changed since 1984.
Well, in government, Labor in fact actually commissioned the Menzies School of Health Research to undertake a framework to look at exactly these issues. And in government, we utilise that framework regularly to review items on the Medicare benefit schedule. The issue, not so much today, is that there isn't a need to look at low-value items on the Medicare benefit schedule. It's the way in which this government has gone about it. And unfortunately, both the sort of way in which they've announced the review and announced the consultation process yesterday has obviously pitted doctors now against the government. And that is unfortunate because the review has some potential, but unfortunately the way in which they've handled it has really mucked it up.
Okay, but if, as you say, you've conducted reviews throughout your time in government, why is it the case then that that the chair of the review says that no less than 30% of health expenditure is still wasted on services that provide no clinical benefit?
That figure is highly contested, so you need to be very careful about the use of it. It's a contested figure. It's a figure that comes out of the US, which has a very different Medicare benefit schedule to ours, so I'm very cautious about that. I think Adam Alshorg out of Menzies has identified around 150 Medicare benefit schedule items, and I think that's obviously a well less than 30% that they want to have a first initial look at. And as I said, our lived experience of this in government is it's right to have a look at items, it's right to have a look at low value. You want to make sure that you are doing the right thing by patients, both from a quality and safety point of view. But what this government seems to have done is literally like a bull in a china shop, throw it all up on the table, let's review all 5,700 items. They've got the medical profession offside, and our lived experience of this in government is if you don't bring them with you, you end up in a war and you end up with patients in the middle and patients paying more for their health care.
Well, certainly the AMA is a very powerful lobby group, and they do exercise that power strongly.
Well, it's not just the AMA, and I've been meeting over the course of the last few weeks. It's all of the colleges, so a number of colleges and surgeons, physicians. It's also some of the societies and associations. So it's not just the Australian Medical Association. Obviously, they're the peak group. It is all of the coalface clinical providers who are saying this is not the way to go about it. They originally signed on to the review. Labor has, in fact, and I think I put a piece in The Guardian back at the time, just before the review was announced, saying this is a sensible way of reform. But the other issue, which the government has again completely mucked up, is that they have not made a commitment, a guarantee, that when they do find savings, and there will be savings from this exercise, that they're going to be reinvested back into listing new procedures, enhancing technology, enhancing health outcomes, trialling things like integrated primary care. Basically, it looks very much to us like a cynical savings exercise, and the government is looking for more savings.
So do you not accept that there is a level of over-servicing and waste?
I've certainly said that there is absolutely a need for a review of low-value Medicare items. We did that in government, but if you don't bring the clinical community with you, then you've got a real problem, and it's patients who end up paying for it. So the approach the government took, particularly yesterday, announcing on a Sunday a big splash, the way in which they did it has clearly created incredible anxiety in the medical profession, and they have absolutely wasted and squandered an opportunity here, and I don't know whether they'll get it back now.
Now, as I'm sure you're aware, there's a report on Four Corners tonight that suggests that this waste is across the board, in fact, in health, and the program argues that 30% of the $155 billion we spend on health broadly is wasted on unnecessary procedures. Should there be an even wider review?
Well, again, that's a contested figure, so you have to take that 30% with some caution. There's been for some time now, about 12 years, a Choosing Wisely campaign out of Philadelphia in the US, which has been a clinician-led program, which has actually looked at this very issue. I, in fact, actually visited the US back in July, and I met with the Choosing Wisely campaign. It's very recently been launched in Australia. And one of the very, very clear messages for government out of that is that if governments go into these exercises around quality and safety with a cost-saving measure at the forefront, which is what this government has done, it is doomed to failure and you won't get that clinical engagement. So there's a pretty clear lesson out of the Choosing Wisely campaign. I think the Four Corners report will highlight, I suspect, some of the items that Choosing Wisely has been looking at in the United States as well, like arthroscopes, x-rays for lower back pain. It is right to look at those issues, but if you don't have clinicians actively engaged in the process, it will fail.
But how do you find this over-servicing problem then if you don't actually carry out some broad investigation into it?
Well,
what do you do about it?
Yeah, so that's what we did in government. So getting
But it's still happening, is my point.
No, well, so what we systematically did, so you remember in government, there were MBS items, some of the rules were changed to those, some of them were removed, and no one, there was no fuss about those. There was one in particular where there was a big fuss about it, and clinicians really geared up, and the now government in opposition ran a very strong campaign against us on these issues, and that was the issue of cataract surgery. We had to go back, we had to go and negotiate with ophthalmologists around that, because basically the end result of it was that patients were going to be paying a lot more for their procedures as a result of what we were trying to do, which was sensible reform in the MBS. So we learned, and from our lived experience, if you don't engage with those clinicians, it is patients who will pay in the end. And the government has been entirely very naive about this, like a bull in a china shop, just racing in, and really they need to take a much more cautious approach to this if they're actually going to get the reform they need and patients aren't going to end up paying.
Okay, Catherine King, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much for joining us.
Really good to talk to you.
That's the Shadow Health Minister, Catherine King, there. According to figures released last week, we as a nation spend just under $155 billion on healthcare. That's by governments, private health insurers and patients in out-of-pocket costs not covered by Medicare or insurance. And while politicians like to say we have an unsustainable healthcare system, tonight's Four Corners, as we've heard, argues there's plenty of money if we redirect the 30% or $46 billion that's wasted. Norman Swan of RN's Health Report has the story.
There's waste everywhere you look in Australian healthcare. It occurs for many reasons, but often because of tests and treatments that are performed which are unnecessary, could have got the same benefit for less money, or which are harmful.
We know that patients are being harmed by receiving tests and treatments that they should never have received. And yes, there's a cost to that. And that cost should also be counted, because those are dollars that are wasted and could have been reallocated to other areas of medicine.
Adam Elshaug of the University of Sydney is an international authority in what's called low-value care, and there's a lot of it. Tonight's Four Corners takes just four examples of low-value care, where the savings from one alone, unnecessary scans and x-rays for low back pain, could pay for a suicide prevention program that'd save 1,000 lives a year.
This is Canberra MCR. He had Q on, faded.
The same pattern. A system which is designed to encourage unnecessary tests, which lead to inappropriate and costly healthcare journeys where the beneficiaries aren't always the patients. Robin Ward of the University of Queensland chairs the committee that decides what tests and procedures Medicare should pay for.
If people knew that health interventions were not going to deliver benefit, I think they might make different choices. At the moment, there is not a great understanding that potentially these tests are offering very little in the way of outcomes, and in some times actually harming people.
What's often going on is a process called overdiagnosis. Professor Paul Glasziou of Bond University is a pioneer of evidence-based healthcare.
It's that we tend to, with our powerful imaging techniques, the screening techniques that we're using and the definitions of diseases, we're classing and detecting a lot more people as being diseased than we used to.
Surprisingly, few medical conditions are clear-cut. You'd think that you either have osteoporosis, cancer, diabetes or heart disease or not, but that's not necessarily the case. Doctors draw a line, say with blood pressure or blood sugar, above which they think the risk of a stroke or diabetic side effects is high enough to warrant treatment. And these decisions have often been influenced by industry and groups who stand to profit from the new market for drugs and tests.
The increase in healthcare costs has been driven a little bit by ageing, a little bit by increases in the costs of technologies, but the largest drivers are overdiagnosis and overtreatment. That is going to get worse. So we're headed for a tsunami of overdiagnosis. All that technology is not necessarily going into the right place. We're overusing it in the well, and we're underusing it in the people who really need it. Medicine is now spending so much time worrying the well that we don't have time to take care of the sick.
Professor Paul Glasziou, and you can see more on that story on Four Corners tonight at 8:30 on ABC television. You're listening to AM Around Australia, where it's 24 minutes past 7. A group of senior women from remote Aboriginal communities in Central Australia say a reluctance to report domestic violence is a serious issue in the region. But as they celebrate their 35th anniversary, members of the NPY Women's Council say they're working to address the problem. Natalie Whiting filed this report from Umuwa in South Australia.
More than 130 senior Aboriginal women gathered for the NPY Women's Council annual general meeting. They travelled from remote communities in the Northern Territory, Western Australia and South Australia to meet in Umuwa in the Anangu Pitjantjatjara Yunkajara lands. The meeting also marked the corporation's 35th anniversary.
And finally, a message from Nigel Scullion, the Minister for Indigenous Affairs, and he wishes us all well
The women came together and spoke for 3 days about issues in their communities. Some sat in the shade provided by a tin shed, others in the sun and red dirt. NPY chairwoman Yanyi Bandicha says the council plays a vital role in building stronger and safer communities. She says as senior women, they have influence.
They stand strong and they talk with those young men who are doing wrong things, and sometimes they listen what their mothers are saying.
Ms. Bandicha says fighting domestic violence is a big focus for the council. Indigenous women are 34 times more likely to be hospitalised from domestic violence than other women in the community. A reluctance to report abuse is also a major problem.
We've got a lot of policemen in every community, police stations, NPY Women Council. See them, they always ask them for help.
And is that a message you're trying to get to other women?
Yes. Yeah.
The federal government has announced a $100 million fund to help tackle domestic violence. $21 million of that will be for Indigenous communities. One of the NPY directors, Janet Inyika, says the funding is needed in the region.
Domestic violence is a big problem for community. We need more to help.
The council is also focusing on better protecting children in communities. Ms. Inyika says drugs and alcohol are continuing to cause havoc in families.
Natalie Whiting with that report. The Wallabies have eased to victory over Uruguay in the Rugby World Cup with a 65-3 win. That's put them back into the top of the Pool A standings ahead of next Saturday's clash with hosts England. ABC Grandstand's rugby commentator Tim Gavel was watching the match, and I spoke to him a little earlier. Tim Gavel, 65-3, seems like a pretty convincing win, but apparently there were a number of mistakes and some sloppy play as well, which have sort of undermined that.
Well, that's right, Michael. It was at times a brilliant performance from the Wallabies, but frustrating at the same time. They scored 11 tries in Birmingham overnight, but 19 handling errors. That would have been a real worry to coach Michael Checker. So many tries were left on the park, but the Wallabies, I thought, showed glimpses there, but it'll need a far better performance if they're to defeat the tougher sides in this competition. Let's not forget that Uruguay are the lowest-ranked team in the World Cup, so a high score was expected. Michael Checker, the Wallabies coach, said the game was actually harder than the scoreline suggests.
I thought it was a pretty rugged game, to be honest. I think the Uruguayans, the Argentinians as well, the South American teams, they play the game physical, and they've got no shortage of desire, and they came hard at us, and I think we wanted to play the game in a physical manner as well, so I enjoyed that part of the game, but I think we've still got a lot of improvement.
And Michael Checker said this game was going to be something of a selection contest for the games to come, particularly the big game against England next week. What have we learnt from this game in that regard?
Not too much, I wouldn't have thought. It was virtually a training run for the Wallabies against Uruguay. They put on some fantastic set-piece moves, but at other times the ball was dropped, you know, almost at the same time. And you thought, well, what have we learned here? Well, Quade Cooper, I don't think, is going to make his way into the starting side. He only kicked 5 from 11, spent 10 minutes in the sin bin for a high tackle in a frustrating performance. By the way, the Wallabies are considering appealing against Cooper's third yellow card in 4 test matches. The only player that might force his way into the side is Drew Mitchell, who scored 2 tries, his 12th in World Cup history, and I thought he was simply brilliant last night. The other player that might force his way is Sean McMahon, but he's got Michael Hooper and David Pocock in front of him, so unlikely to force his way into the starting side.
What do we know about how England is placed? They've obviously had a tough game against Wales, but they would have to go into that game the favourite, wouldn't they?
Michael Checker has indicated, and I don't know whether or not it is mind games, but he says that England are the favourites. They're playing at home at Twickenham in front of their home crowd with so much to play for, so much pressure. He says that England are the favourites, but Australia on their day, more than capable of matching it with England. This, of course, is the pool of death, and Wales, with a come-from-behind victory on the weekend, certainly appear to be the side that is the one to beat at the moment, but they have a growing injury toll. Another 2 players suffered injuries, and they're looking at calling in a replacement. You'd have to think that, England, with so much to play for, will come out with so much passion in this game. Australia has to match that passion if they're going to win this game.
ABC Grandstand's rugby commentator Tim Gavel. On the financial markets, gold is trading around $1,145.86 an ounce. The Australian dollar is buying 70.1 US cents. That's the program for today. I'm Michael Brissenden. It's 7:30.